Today, we're going to be talking about the transforming vision. And it's interesting to see how the Lord puts these things together. The theme of, Shine got kind of destroyed up here, I'm afraid, by the mass movement of children out. But the theme was to shine Jesus's light and so forth. And what you're going to see is the theme of this sermon is also tied to the concept of shining. And I didn't plan that. So it's interesting to see how this all works out. Now, we're going to be dealing with 1 Corinthians chapter 3. We're continuing in our study in the book of 1 Corinthians. We're going to be focusing on the last verse in the chapter, verse 18. And before we do that, though, I want to talk about transformation. And as I thought about this, I was thinking, you know, I really would like to come up with a great transforming story for you. So I did some searching and I found this wonderful story. And I wanted to share it with you about the transforming power of the gospel. And I hope you'll find it edifying. And this is a story about a man by the name of Ramesh. Yeah, that's right. Okay, good. This is working. Thank you. And I'm not even going to make an attempt to pronounce this last name. I just said I wasn't going to do it. Okay. So, this is the story of Ramesh, who spent much of his youth fending for himself on the streets of India. He ran away from home when he was 11 to escape an abusive father, only to end up in a Christian orphanage where he was periodically beaten by the pastor in charge. At age 14, he left the orphanage and stayed on the streets for good, determined to support himself by doing odd jobs, learning to work as a mechanic and an electrician. As a young man, Ramesh decided he wanted nothing to do with God. He had been abused by both Hindus and Christians, so he figured that choosing between good and evil was simply up to him. I was an atheist, and I hated the thought of God, he admits, but I also was a violent person. Ramesh's violent tendencies eventually led to his arrest in 2009 after he was involved in a street fight. His friends escaped the police, but he was captured and he was charged with assault. Even this outcome didn't seem too bad to Ramesh. He thought, well, at least in jail I'll have a secure place to stay for a little while. The turning point for Ramesh came on his 23rd birthday. Many times throughout his life, he'd been alone on the streets, but as he sat in that jail cell on his birthday, for the first time, he felt truly lonely. I realized that nobody would even come claim my body if I died there, he said. The warden noticed Ramesh's somber mood that night and asked what was troubling him. When Ramesh explained it was his birthday, the warden handed him a New Testament. Ramesh was furious. He put it in the corner of his cell. I'm not going to touch that thing. That night, Ramesh couldn't sleep. All he could think about was that Bible. There was this voice inside of me saying, "Open the Bible," and I couldn't resist it, he recalls with a wide smile. So eventually, I got up and opened it. And Ramesh turned to John 14:18, where Jesus says, "I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you." Ramesh felt like somebody was directly speaking to him. For most of his life, he considered himself an orphan with no one to care for him. 2 hours later, he'd read through the entire book of John, amazed at the words of Jesus. "I made a commitment right there to follow Jesus. I was a believer," he said. The next morning, Ramesh experienced the first of many examples of God's providential care for him. The warden came to his cell and told him he was free to go. Confused, Ramesh asked, "How could this be possible?" He was told that a judge from another Indian district had arrived at the jail that very morning and asked specifically for his release. Now, the story goes on, but I love this story. Did you love that story? I love stories of transformation. It's a story about how God opened the eyes of a lost soul and transformed him. Ramesh goes on to tell the story. There's more to the story. He was led to go to a Bible school where he got a bachelor's degree in Bible in northern India, and then he ended up getting a master's of divinity, and he felt a passionate call to train people in the scriptures. And now he's at a seminary here in the United States doing advanced studies, preparing for that call to go and teach the Bible. Now, I'm not going to use this as a commercial to plug our mission and what we do in going around and teaching and doing theological training, but I just did. Okay. But it's a story of transformation. And so the theme of our message this morning is this verse, but we all, with unveiled faces, looking as in a mirror at the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as from the Lord the Spirit. Now, this is a fantastic verse, and in order to really understand it, we have to delve into the context of what Paul is saying here. Now, some of this is going to kind of review what Pastor Andrew's been teaching us in the last few weeks, but in this chapter, Paul's arguing for the legitimacy of his ministry, a ministry that does not need letters of recommendation. Remember Andrew's sermon for a couple of weeks ago? Right? You know, this was a common thing. Get a letter of recommendation. We still do it in our culture today, right? You apply for a job, they want references. Oftentimes they want letters of recommendation. And the reason for this is that he doesn't need this. Instead, he says, my ministry manifests the transforming power of the Holy Spirit. And the reason for this transforming power is that Paul is a servant of a new covenant that is superior to the old covenant. That old covenant was delivered through the ministry of Moses, and it came with great glory, miracles, and as we're going to see, some shining that was going on. But the new covenant, Paul says, has greater glory. Now, if you've got a chance, you want to open up your Bibles to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Go right ahead. I'm going to be reading a little bit from the previous part of this chapter. Now, notice what Paul says in verse 7. Now, if the ministry of death, and the reason Paul calls it the ministry of death is because this is what law does. I used to say to my students, I said, the law is like a thermometer. Okay? Not barometer, a thermometer. The thermometer shows you that you're sick, but it can't heal you. And so when you look at the law of God, especially the way Jesus interpreted it, right? Well, you're not supposed to commit adultery. Well, Jesus said, just looking and thinking about it, you're guilty of it. You're like, whoa. Okay, I've never committed adultery, but I've had the thoughts, right? That's the way people are. So Jesus and the law says to us, here's God's standard, and guess what? You've fallen short of that standard. And we all know the classic verse, right? For all... By the way, our kids knew that. They did. I said, do you know this verse? And they're like, and they could all recite it. So I was really impressed with good work in our children's ministry here. So the ministry of death, carved in letters on stone, came with such glory that the Israelites could not gaze at Moses' face because of its glory, which was being brought to an end. Will not the ministry of the Spirit have even more glory? Now, there's nothing wrong with the Mosaic Law. It's God's standard. It's the truth. It's the right way to live. But as sinners, as people who fall short of God's standard, it ends up condemning us. So if you try to live by the law, you'll fall short. You won't make it. And so what is meant to be righteous ends up causing your condemnation. Now, if you want to delve into this thing in much more detail, read the book of Romans. Paul elaborates this in great detail all through his argument in his epistle to the Romans. So this ministry, carved in letters of stone, says that the new ministry of the Spirit has even more glory. Now, we don't have time to do this, but if we wanted to delve a little deeper in this, and if you want to, go to Jeremiah 31 and read about the new covenant. Go to Ezekiel, I think it's 36. Read about how God's going to put his Spirit within his people, you see. And so the Old Testament foretold this coming of a new way of relationship to God, a new covenant. Maybe you're not familiar with the word covenant. La palabra en español es pacto. Okay, so if you understood what I said, you get a gold star. But a covenant is an agreement, a contract, if you will. And the Mosaic Law was a contract between God. He said, here's my standards. You will only worship me. You won't make idols, right? And you'll honor the Sabbath day and so forth and so on. And if you do this, then I will bless you. I will make you the most fantastic nation on the face of the earth. And Moses went up into the mountain, Mount Sinai. He received the tablets of stone. He brought them down, and what were the Israelites doing? They were breaking the first and second commandments before Moses even got down with the tablets. Now, they had heard those rules. It's not like they'd never heard them yet. But Moses was up there, he got the stone tablets, and he broke them, right? So they broke the covenant from the very first day they had it. So he says in verse 10, indeed, this is the case. What once had glory has come to have no glory at all because of the glory that surpasses it. Just think of one of those, you know, those old Hollywood, big, huge spotlights, you know, that they shine them up into the air. We don't see them much anymore. The older folks are going, yeah, I know what you're talking about. The younger folks are like, what? I don't know what that is. And it's the difference between that searchlight and a candle. Imagine holding that candle up to that searchlight. Now, if you're in a completely dark room and you light one candle, it shines with glory. And that's Paul's point here, is that the glory of the new covenant far outpaces and far surpasses the previous covenant. For if what was being brought to an end came with glory, much more will that which is permanent have glory. So one of the manifestations of that glory in the coming of the old covenant was the shining face of Moses. Okay? And so what I want to do is take a look at Exodus chapter 34. I put it up here so that we don't all have to fumble through our Bibles and get to it. But here is the context of this. The previous two chapters, chapter 32 of Exodus, by the way, these four or five chapters here are some of the most significant in all of the Bible. Okay, it's the giving of the covenant. It's the massive defection of the children of Israel in chapter 32 when Moses comes down out of the mountain and there they've created the golden calf. They're worshiping and committing adultery and immorality and so forth. And then Moses goes back up into the mountain to receive another copy of the Ten Commandments. Okay, he gets a second copy because he destroyed the first ones. So he spends another 40 days and 40 nights of fasting from both water and food up there. Now that's got to be a miracle. You can go 40 days without food, especially if you've got some extra storage. But you cannot go 40 days without water, right? You can only go a few days without water before you die. So God miraculously sustains him for these 40 days. He comes back down to the people with the new stone tablets, and here's where we pick up the story here in verse 29. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai, the two tablets of testimony in his hand, as he came down from the mountain, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he'd been talking with God. Now, I was wondering, if I stood next to this, didn't work, I guess. Okay. Because he'd been talking with God. Aaron and all the people saw Moses, and behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. Afterward, the people of Israel came near, and he commanded them all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with him, he put a veil over his face. And we're going to see how that ties into what we're learning here. And then we have just another statement about this in verse 34 and following. Whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would remove the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the people of Israel what was commanded, the people of Israel would see the face of Moses, and the skin of Moses' face was shining, and then Moses would put the veil over his face again until he went in to speak with God. Now, that's all the Bible says in the Old Testament about this. You're like, well, wow, this is interesting. So Moses beheld the glory of the Lord when he met with him, and it so transformed him that his face just shined. This frightened the people, so that after Moses would speak to them, he would cover his face with a veil. Now, this brings us to the veil. What's a veil? What's its purpose? Well, a veil is something that you put on top of the head or in front of the face to either obscure it or hide it completely. Now, I'm not sure here in the text, I don't know that we can know this for sure, is this one of those veils that you can sort of see through, you know, a sheer fabric, or are we talking about something that completely covers the face? We don't really know that. Either way, it was a way of obscuring the sight of Moses' face. You couldn't see it clearly. You wouldn't be overwhelmed with that glory that was emanating from his face. Now, Paul later on in verses 12 through 16 of our passage, yes, that is 12 through 16, excuse the typo there, makes reference to this. He says, since we have such a hope, we are very bold in our speech, not like Moses, who had put a veil over his face so the Israelites might not gaze at the outcome of what was being brought to an end. Now, if you've done any study on this, you'll probably be aware that there's a couple different ways you can take this. Some interpreters think that Paul is saying that Moses put a veil over his face to hide the fact that the glory of God on his face was fading away. Okay? Others, and the ESV, which is what we have up here, seem to indicate that it's more about the fact that the old covenant was going to die out and was going to be put to an end at some point in time. And so that seems to be what Paul's arguing here, is that this new covenant is superior. It's not going to die out. It's not going to fade away. It's going to remain forever. So the veil was over his face that the Israelites might not gaze at the outcome of what was brought to an end. But their minds were hardened, for to this day, when they read the old covenant, that same veil remains unlifted, because only through Christ it's taken away. Yes, to this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil is over their hearts. But when one turns to the Lord, it's removed. Okay. So the veil obscured the glory of the old covenant, so they were unable to look, and look in the sense of intently look at, even the end of what was going to fade away. So the veil even obscured the glory of the old covenant. Now, this becomes a metaphor for Paul. The hardened heart by sin cannot see the true glory of God and the true nature of the new covenant because that heart remains veiled. Now, look at the context of the children of Israel. What had just happened? They had been given the Ten Commandments, and they immediately broke them and created an idol. And God was about ready to say, I'm going to wipe them all out, and Moses, I'll raise up a nation out of you. And Moses makes intercession for the people. So this is this metaphor of the veil of obscuring the glory of even the old covenant. And Paul says that now that veil remains to those who would not turn to the Lord. So that's what happened. The only way we can do anything about this, I think, is what it says here, to turn to the Lord. Now, what does that mean? I think it means to open your heart to God, to let Him transform you. Let go of your blindness, your bitterness, your sinfulness, and turn to the Lord. This is an action that we can do. We can't transform ourselves. We can just turn. We're headed in this direction. We're holding on to this and that and the other and all our sin and all of our shame and everything. We turn to the Lord and we say, Lord, I need you. Then we arrive at verse 17. Do I have that? No, I don't. Verse 17 says, now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. Paul brings us back to the crux of his argument. The new covenant is a covenant of the Spirit of God. When one turns to the Lord, one is turning to the Spirit, and that is the only way to real liberty. Freedom from legalistic works-based righteousness that the Pharisees practiced. It's not freedom to sin, but freedom from sin. And it's a new Spirit dwelling within us. Well, people are furiously seeking freedom today. Moral freedom to take pride in their urges that in the past were considered immoral or some sort of disorder. I ran across a travel advertisement last week at a travel site, and actually I got an email, I think it was from a travel site, and it says, it's time to celebrate living as your most authentic self. So travel to one of these pride celebrations. Okay. They want liberty. They want freedom to be their most authentic self. The problem is they're sinners. Problem is we're sinners. We don't want to be our authentic selves. We want to be transformed by the power of the Spirit. So that's the crux of the argument. And that brings us to our verse today. Verse 18, but we all with unveiled faces. You understand that now? The veil's been taken away. We've turned to the Lord. And we now can see the glory of the new covenant. We now can see the glory of God. But notice what it says, looking as in a mirror. And this, by the way, is the New American Standard Translation, and I don't mean to cut down the ESV, but I don't like it here, because the actual word mirror, it's a compound word, looking at the mirror is the root meaning of the Greek here. And so I like this way of seeing it, because the idea is not that we're able to look directly into the face of God. No, at this point in time, we're not able to do that. We're still sinful creatures. We're not able to do that, but we can look as in a mirror. We can see a reflection of the glory of God. See? And that in and of itself is transformational. Now, if you recall, and this is one of the most beautiful passages in the Old Testament, Moses in Exodus 33 says, Lord, Lord, show me your glory. Remember that? And Lord says, look, you can't look right into my face. So I'm going to put you in the cleft of the rock, put his hand over and he passed by. And Moses got just a little barely glimpse at the back parts of God. Now, I think that's all metaphoric language. I don't think that God's got front and back parts and feet and things like that. But in other words, Moses only caught a brief glimpse of a small part of God's glory, and his face shone, right? It transformed him. Because we've turned to the Lord, we have unveiled faces, we can gaze intently in the mirror here of God's glory. So, looking intently at the glory of God, reflect us in a mirror, and this gaze morphs us into, notice what it says, into the same image. Okay, the same image. Now, Paul reflects this idea in Romans 8:29. He says, for those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be saved? No, to become conformed to the image of his son, that he would be the firstborn amongst many brethren. That's what God's goal is for you as someone who's turned to the Lord, to be conformed to the image of Christ. From glory to glory, some translations, that's literally what the Greek says, from glory to glory. The question is, what does that mean? Probably in the sense of from the glory of the old covenant to the increasing glory of the new covenant. Just as from the Lord the Spirit. So, how do we do this? Is this the way? Set up a habit of 20 minutes of Bible reading every day. Okay? At least 15 minutes of prayer every day. And then 1 hour of self-sacrificial service each day, and then serving at Vacation Bible School. And what will happen? Stellar transformation. Okay. No, this is not the way. Okay. So what is really the way? You older folks won't understand this. I think that this is the essence of that. I really kind of struggle with this. Like, how do we implement this? What do we do? And I think it's all about inner attitude. And it starts with the inner attitude. You're going to see the glory of God in the Scriptures. So you need to read the Scriptures. But you don't read the Scriptures as a formula for transformation. You read the Scriptures because it's a heart that says to God, like Moses, show me your glory. It's a heart that says to the Lord, I want to know you. Say, that's what Moses said. He said, Lord, I want to know you. It's relational. You see that? It's not action-oriented. It's relational. It's a heart that says to God, I'll do what you say. I will obey you. And it's a heart that says to God, I will follow where you lead. And it's a heart that desires to be with God. And this will take time. It's a relationship. Our veil has been taken away. We can now gaze upon the glory of the Lord, but we need to give it time and attention. So while, you know, we don't pursue a legalistic course of you got to have this, you got to do that, you got to do this. But on the other hand, if this relationship is important to you, you got to give it time. A young couple contemplating marriage, you know, they're not going to say like, well, in 3 weeks, I can give you an hour at lunchtime. That ain't going to work, right? You make time to be together because that relationship is critical to you. So yes, we see the glory in his word. Yes, we need to spend time with God in prayer, but the motivation is different. It's not to gain points with God, it's to know God, to comprehend his glory, to bask in his presence, in short, to truly love God. You know, I remember when I was young, about 10 years ago. Actually, I was my early teen years. I remember being afraid of the appearing of Jesus. You ever have that thing? You know, especially when you're young, you're like, I don't want Jesus to come back now. I haven't had a chance to get married and have children and buy a house and have a nice car and you know, et cetera. You know, you're thinking about life. You say like, well, I want my chance to have my life. Don't come back yet, Jesus. And in other words, I was focused on the things of the world. If Jesus came back before I could have those things, it would be a loss. And I'm thinking about this verse that I think is kind of a corollary to what Paul is saying here. John says, beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet appeared as yet what we will be. We know that when he appears, catch this, we will be like him because we will see him as he is. See? We will not be seeing Jesus in a mirror anymore. We'll be comprehending his glory just like Peter, James, and John did on the Mount of Transfiguration. And Jesus was transfigured into this glorious person that he is in his essence. And this will transform us. We will be like him. That final transformation into the image of Christ will be complete. And notice verse 3. And everyone who has this hope fixed upon him purifies himself, just as he's pure. See? This kind of speaks to the core of our affection. As Jonathan Edwards would call it, genuine religious affections. What do you really care about? What is really important? See? And so what I think Paul's saying here is that with our unveiled face, we come and we begin to see the glory of the new covenant. We begin to see the glory of Jesus, the glory of God. And even though it's only a reflection as looking in a mirror, it's still transformational. It's transforming us into that image that one day, when Jesus returns, we will experience in fullness. I recall the words of a great little chorus, turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full. Now, somebody said I was supposed to sing this, so I'm going to resist that temptation. Look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace.